In a conversation with Pastor Bergner on 27th of May 1941, Admiral Darnan stated, "I worked with the English for 15 years. They always lied to me. I've negotiated with the Germans for 3 months, and they've never misled me." Pastor Bergner pointed out that, in fact, Hitler had continuously violated the most solemn agreements, but this had little effect on Darnan. Now, this self-delusion or willful amnesia may just have been Darnan trying to justify his pursuit of collaboration with Germany, but what that quotation highlights is how in Vichy, the belief in British duplicity was both deeply rooted and widely held. Virtually all the scholarship on Vichy's foreign policy portrays a pervasive Anglophobia that was both deeply embedded in resentments and suspicions, of British intentions towards France. At the heart of the problem was the fact that the age-old rivalry between Britain and France happened to revolve around the two key assets upon which Vichy's claims to sovereignty and status as a global power depended, namely its colonial empire and its navy. What I want to explore today briefly is how, in the turbulence of the French collapse, perceptions of Britain operated to become critical shaping factors in Vichy's foreign policy, rather than balanced analyses of how French interests might be best protected in the circumstances in which France found itself after the armistice. Distrust, suspicion, and even paranoia gained new credence. The absence of direct diplomatic contact between the UK and France during much of this period created a vacuum into which these suspicions were highlighted and in which British actions that conflicted with French interests served to legitimise this mistrust. While historians have devoted considerable attention to the factors that drew Vichy into collaborating with Nazi Germany, just as important are the considerations that shaped its move away from its former ally, Britain. Now, it's not difficult to find evidence of the strains in the relations between the UK and France in the years leading up to the Second World War, and we've already heard some of that today. But I want to look briefly at the evidence that Anglophobia had become endemic among the key institutions and individuals who shaped Vichy's foreign policy. Now, certainly in the French colonial service, the long history of rivalry with Britain and memories of the Fashoda incident of 1898 still loomed large. This deeply rooted hostility was instrumental in many colonial officers' decision to support Vichy rather than to join with the British and the Free French in 1940. In the French Navy, while many historians have portrayed a similar picture of traditional antipathy towards Britain, the reality is perhaps a bit more nuanced. After the initial shock of Mercer Kebir, many officers reflected that they didn't wish to be drawn into doing Germany's bidding in engaging with hostilities against Britain. This culture of antipathy towards Britain became significant because under Vichy, senior figures from the Navy and Army came to occupy key positions of authority over French foreign policy. Viewing Britain through the prism of this anti-British sentiment, they tended to distort and exaggerate the nature of the threat from Britain. Indeed, Peter Jackson and Simon Kitson have argued that not only was Admiral Darnan's strategic vision conditioned by an imperial worldview and the Anglophobia of the French Navy, but that his whole approach in government was shaped by the ideological and geopolitical vision that he had developed as a naval officer. According to Bernard Costellola, the French Navy's Anglophobia had so embedded itself upon Darnan that he had come to believe that 5 generations of his family had been ruined by the death of his great-grandfather at the hands of the British at Trafalgar, even though in reality there is no evidence that any of his relatives actually fought in the battle. It sort of seems to be somehow a kind of invented memory. So the question is how far these distorted and inflated suspicions of Britain prevailed over balanced, objective analysis in shaping assessments of France's future at the end of the war, and consequently the direction of French foreign policy under Vichy. How far was it the case, as Hervé Couto-Bergeret and Claude Juin have suggested, that Darlan's Anglophobia so blinded him to the realities of Nazi intentions towards France, that he believed that France would gain more favourable terms from a German victory rather than a British one? What is perhaps most striking is how, among the relatively few voices who argued in favour of Vichy maintaining at least a modus vivendi with the UK, none sought to justify this on grounds of historical or cultural affinity. Instead, arguments rested on notions that a British-led victory would be the least worst option for France, which is hardly a ringing endorsement. So what I want to make is a brief comparison with how this cultural argument, these perceptions, operated very differently in relation to Britain as compared to Italy. The very challenging and complex situations in which the French and the British governments found themselves in during the war caused each to have to defend their own interests in ways that were sometimes damaging to the other. Just as the British government was alarmed at some of the actions taken by the French, so a number of actions taken by the British gave Vichy real legitimate concerns. And the first of these was, of course, the British attack on the French fleet at Marcel-Kébir on the 3rd of July, 1940. While Franco-British relations had been tense since the French surrender, it was this act of what Vichy saw as an unjustified act of aggression that caused the formal severing of diplomatic relations between the two states, enabled Foreign Minister Paul Baudouin's Directeur du Cabinet to declare that France was henceforth free from any obligations towards its former ally. The fallout of Marcel-Kébir might have been surmountable had it not been followed so soon by a British and Free French attack at Dakar on the 23rd to the 5th of September 1940. The attack on Dakar shattered the détente in Franco-British relations that had been so painstakingly rebuilt after Marcel-Kébir. The fact that there had been no call for British help from the people of Dakar only fed into Vichy's narrative of Britain's malign intentions towards France's colonial empire, and it allowed Baudouin, who had been seeking to improve relations, to assert that the British government was using the pretext of threat from the Axis for eliminating a powerful rival navy and seizing the spoils of a defeated former ally. However legitimate the military and strategic justifications may have been, they didn't mitigate what was arguably a political misjudgment that played directly into Vichy's suspicions. And the British bombing of Sfax in May 1941 and the British occupation of Madagascar in 1942 only fueled these beliefs. Even when the British government did seek to reassure Vichy that it didn't have malign intentions, its lack of attention to French sensitivities only aggravated matters. In a note sent to the French government via Madrid on the 21st October 1940, the British government sought to assure Vichy that it would restore France's, quote, independence and grandeur after the war. The problem was, however, that the note's assertion that France was, quote, powerless to protect its empire from German or Italian infiltration and that it needed British assistance to do so went entirely against Vichy's insistence that it would defend the sovereignty of its colonial empire. The language of the British note may have been clumsy, but it was a measure of a lack of faith in Vichy's assurances. The problem was that the French and British governments had fundamentally opposing approaches and priorities in relation to the French colonial empire. A significant gulf emerged between Vichy's exaggerated insistence that it retained a high level of sovereignty and British suspicions that the French government would be unable to resist Axis demands. For the British government, the risk of the French empire and navy falling into Axis hands outweighed the need to allay French suspicions. So when Baudouin sought assurance that the British government would not seek to detach France's colonies from Vichy's control, Churchill refused. At the heart of Vichy's foreign policy were the conflicting impulsions of weighing up the most likely outcome of the war against the preferred outcome. In the initial months after the French surrender, few believed that there was any realistic prospect of a British victory. Even as the tide started to turn against the Axis in 1941, officials at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs concluded that the most that Britain could hope for was a compromise peace. But whereas diplomats maintained that a German-led victory would be significantly more harmful to France than a British-led one, the likes of Darlan, Laval and Pétain maintained the opposite. Numerous reports, including from sources sympathetic to Vichy, stated that any unpleasantness from having to endure future British domination would be as nothing compared to the territorial and material losses that Germany would impose. In his analysis for the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs on the 14th of October 1940, Charles summed up the unanimous view of diplomats in stating that a, quote, Pax Britannica would be infinitely less disadvantageous for us than a Pax Germanica. Without concrete assurances from the Axis, he argued, Vichy was playing a fool's game in defending its colonies against the British and the Free French, only to find that it then lost them to Germany or Italy or even Spain or Japan later on. Yet despite criticisms, even from colleagues such as General Dwyer, who headed the French Armistice Commission for Italy, that their assessments that a German, that their assessments of German intentions towards France were not based on political realities, Darlan, Laval, and Pétain continued to maintain that French interests were better safeguarded under Germany than under Britain. So I want to draw a very brief comparison between Vichy's dogmatic distrust of Britain and the way that Vichy viewed Italy. Now, as with Britain, Vichy had a long-running colonial and naval rivalry with Italy, especially in the Mediterranean. France and Italy had also been allies in the First World War, and the governments had also diverged over the peace terms in 1919. But as with Britain, it was from the fall of France that a narrative of betrayal developed. The Italian declaration of war on France on the 10th of June 1940, as France was already on the verge of collapse, was widely seen as Italy stabbing France in the back. And yet, despite all of this, between July 1940 and November 1942, at various points, Baudouin, Laval, and Darlan each sought a rapprochement with Italy, claiming that it was France's natural ally. Now, the need to ease the burden of the German armistice terms led to the creation of a cultural rationale that enabled Vichy to transcend the resentments over past Italian action and suspicions about Italian intentions. Over late summer and autumn of 1940, Laval and Baudouin engaged in sustained efforts at rapprochement with the Italian government, citing cultural and historical affinity as two Latin and Catholic countries. These attempts at an alignment with fascist Italy were not ideologically driven pursuits of collaboration with Germany. Indeed, the summer and autumn of 1940 and in the winter of 1941, Laval, Baudouin and Darlan separately, of course, sought explicitly to appeal to Mussolini to isolate the German government, weaken its domination and pressurize it into granting concessions on the armistice terms. So what this comparison suggests is that these cultural perceptions functioned as shaping elements, but not necessarily determining factors in the formulation of Vichy's foreign policy. Now, the sudden brutal nature of the rupture in Franco-British relations in July 1940 was perhaps best summed up by the Marquis de Castellane, the first secretary to the French embassy in London. Diplomats had spent years working to create an atmosphere of reciprocal trust and friendship between Britain and France. But after the attack on Marcel Kabir, quote, this closeness was destroyed within the space of one day. We suddenly went from the closest of alliances to acts of hostility, a situation which has perhaps no precedent in modern history, end of quote. Yet despite this, I want to suggest that there was nothing inevitable or irreversible in the rupture in relations. And this isn't to rehash or revisit old ideas of Vichy playing some sort of double game, but rather the picture is one of misunderstanding and willful misrepresentation due in no small part to the changes and reduction in influence of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I think Darlan's shift in November 1942 to the Allies, despite his antipathy towards Britain, highlights how this hostility was something that could be used and manipulated depending on the political circumstances. According to François Chalroux, the Secretary General at the Foreign Ministry, ministers in Vichy suspected the entire French diplomatic service of disapproving of the government's foreign policy and harbouring sympathies for Britain. As a consequence, many experienced diplomats were recalled, retired, moved, or, like Chalroux, resigned. Foreign policy came increasingly under the domain of two men who had little recent experience in foreign affairs. Indeed, Laval and Darlan were driven by their own political agendas and personal views. Since leaving office in 1936, Laval had been cut off from his sources of information at the Quai d'Orsay and was consequently out of touch when he returned to government in June 1940. And Darlan's lack of experience saw him out of his depth and outmaneuvered. When he finally got to meet Ciano in December 1941, the meeting between the two of them just shows this sense in which he was just really out of his depth. Ciano apparently said after meeting Darlan that he was quite disappointed, and he said he had expected to meet a real admiral, not a faux politician. And Darlan himself was a bit upset at Ciano's negative views of him, and he replied he had expected to meet an amateur diplomat, not a professional gigolo. In the negotiations for the Protocols of Paris, Darlan was also, of course, outmaneuvered. He made significant concessions to Germany on the use of French airfields in Syria and the port of Bizerte, Tunisia, for little in return. French diplomats expressed deep concern about Darlan's ignorance of Nazi ideology and the delusion of those in Vichy, who believed that the final peace terms would be something like those at the end of the Franco-Prussian War, in which France would lose Alsace and Lorraine, pay some indemnities, but that would be more or less the end of the story. The chaotic and inexpert nature of Franco-British relations during this period is perhaps best epitomised in Louis Rougier's unofficial mission to Britain, in which he exaggerated his authority, misled his interlocutors in London and Vichy, and ultimately only made matters worse. As Baudouin noted in September 1940, one of the consequences of allowing these emotive negative perceptions to prevail over balanced analysis was that Franco-British relations had become a seemingly endless string of unfortunate incidents. And of course, the main beneficiary of these misunderstandings was Germany.